Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. Would
you like to reserve any rebuttal time?
5 minutes, please.
All right.
Thank you. My name is Mark Stokes. I represent your appellant, Kelvin Watford, in this matter. There's only one assignment of error before the court in this matter, and that pertains to the granting of a jury instruction, specifically jury instruction number 8, as noted in the appendix, which purported to define and or expand upon or explain jury instruction number 9, which is supposed to define physical impairment. Jury instruction number 8, the objected to jury instruction, purported to essentially define what permanent and significant means in the context of an aggravated malicious wounding. Factually, in the factual summary of this case, insofar as it pertains to this appeal, really only deals with the injury, so that's what I'll focus on. If there's more facts that the court needs, I'm happy to explain those things. The Commonwealth presented before the jury that in March of 2015, Mario Vaughn was the victim of a shooting in Chesapeake, Virginia.
Well, we're familiar with the facts. Isn't the bottom line here whether or not it was proper to instruct the jury as to what the definition of permanent and significant injury was in the context of a scar?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I understand from your brief that basically you're not taking the position that the instruction was an incorrect statement of the law. You're simply taking the position that because it came from an appellate opinion, it shouldn't have been given at all. Is that essentially
That's part of my argument, Your Honor. Again, I do agree that it is not an incorrect statement of law, and it's specifically the cases that were cited, and I must correct myself. I believe from the record at trial I argued that it was dicta. I was being presented those cases for the first time that day. Obviously, since reviewing...
Clearly weren't dicta.
Certainly not. Certainly not dicta, and I apologize for that characterization of the case law. But the case that was cited was Harris, which is an unpublished case.
Let me put this question to you. Suppose the hypothetical situation. Suppose that instruction had not been given.
Correct.
And the jury comes out with a question. The question is, does a scar count as a permanent or significant injury? Could the court answer that question?
I believe not, Your Honor.
Why not?
I believe that's a matter to be left to the common sense of the jury, and I believe that this court has held that in other cases.
Well, let me give you a different hypothetical. Charges is DUI. Defendant is charged with, the facts indicate the defendant is not actually driving the car, but operating the vehicle, which is covered by the statute.
Correct.
Our Supreme Court has ruled that operating any of the electrical equipment constitutes operating. Would it be proper to instruct the jury to the effect that the definition of operating is engaging any of the electrical equipment of the car?
I would think so if the Supreme Court of Virginia has defined the definition of operating.
So it's okay if the Supreme Court defines it, but it's not okay if we define it.
I didn't mean that. I meant if it was defined for the purpose of clarifying a codified statute. The cases that it was cited, and Harris cites Martinez, Newton, and Cody, however that's pronounced. That's not the purpose that those cases were for. Those were not appealed on assignment of errors to jury instructions.
Well, let me ask you this. I think we all understand the law as to that just because a appellate court opinion states something, that does not necessarily mean that it is appropriate for a jury instruction in every case, certainly based on the facts. But can't a court opinion in the right context be used for purposes of a jury instruction?
I can't argue with that point. My argument, and it's in
your argument, is under these facts, it's not right.
Under these facts, the specific jury instruction, which only dealt with scars, and I think it's important to note that the jury instruction that was granted over objection only dealt with scars. Again, not an incomplete statement of law, not an incorrect statement of law, but perhaps an incomplete statement of the law. That jury instruction, which stated that scars not visible, if I could have the correct language, that visible scars, scars connected with nerve damage, and scars not visible during ordinary daily activities have been held to be permanent significant impairment in this court. That those things are so specific that a jury hearing this case and hearing the testimony before it that this victim testified about and showed the victim two scars.
Well, let me follow up
no
on
discretion.
Let me follow up on Judge Decker's question. How, given that we reverse trial court error, that's our job, and given that you're not asserting this is an incorrect statement of the law, simply that it should not have been given, mm-hmm. How is it not harmless error if it's error? I mean, in other words, if the judge gave a correct statement of the law to the jury, even though it was inadvisable to do so because it came from an appellate opinion. How could that be reversible error if the statement of law he gave them was correct in the first instance?
So in order to answer your question, I would have to assume then that there was no jury instruction number 8. So absent that instruction, the question is whether or not there would have been it there, because if with that
jury
instruction.
No.
I'm saying it's clearly, let's assume it's error. It should not have been given.
Correct.
But since you conceded it's a correct statement of the law, how is it not harmless error to give it?
It's not harmless error because of the resulting impact that it has upon the jury's deliberations.
They're instructed to follow the law, and we're agreeing that that's a correct statement of the law. So how is the jury being misled by giving them a correct statement of the law?
It's a correct statement of law in a vacuum, Your Honor. It's a correct statement of law in a vacuum. It's a correct statement of law as pertains to Martinez, Newton, as to Cotty. It's a correct statement of law as it pertains to Harris. In Harris, there was a gash with 13 staples, a still visible wound. Those are the things being referenced. In Lamb versus Commonwealth, this court held that, and it cites Martinez, stating that it's within the common, excuse me, it can be left to the common sense of the jury to determine if injuries are permanent. It's a correct statement of law in the vacuum. But as it pertains to this case, it leaves the jury no discretion to determine
whether.
Well, the jury,
it does leave the jury discretion to look at and look at the photos and look at the victim and determine if there's a scar. Right?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
So,
but once
jury,
it determines that,
so
there's
the
no
jury has the factual has the ability to make the factual determination.
Correct. If there's a scar, the jury has the ability to determine if there's a scar, and we're not conceding that, and we're not contesting that there were scars. The facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth indicated that the victim showed and testified about scarring on his face. And
was it also uncontested that he continued to suffer numbness, burning, and slurred speech?
Correct. It was uncontested. He testified to those
things. That would certainly be evidence of permanence.
And it could be, and that's certainly within the purview of the jury to determine if that represented permanence.
Okay, that's why I'm going back to the harmless error. But it's still your contention that it was an abuse of discretion to grant the instruction that focused on the visibility of the scar.
It is, and I would posit that it's not a harmless error because essentially it puts a wall up for the jury that they don't have to consider those things that Your Honor mentioned. They don't have to, because if they see a scar, it's permanent significant. And that's not what this court has ever held. This court has never held that there's a bright line rule that a scar is a permanent significant impairment. Now, independently,
if we held that, would that be a proper jury instruction?
I think so, yes. But that's never been the holding of this court. And again, I'm not stating that it's a misstatement of the law. It's just that those statements are made in a vacuum as it pertains to the case and the factual scenarios of which
Let me try this another way. So is your argument basically that by giving that instruction, it would confuse the jury?
No, I'm arguing that by giving that instruction, the jury has no authority to make a decision for themselves as to whether this is permanent significant. The Commonwealth, in fact, argues that without that instruction,
but juries are given definitions all the time,
right.
Counsel. I mean, juries are given instruction.
But the court has never held that that's the definition of permanent and significant. It has been held that those things can be permanent significant, but it's not the definition of permanent significant.
Well, what the jury instruction actually said is permanent and significant impairment includes visible scars, scars connected with nerve damage, and scars not visible during ordinary daily activities, which of course comes from our opinion. So it doesn't specifically instruct the jury that essentially on the ultimate issue, there's a scar here, so you got to find him guilty, which I guess is where you're going with your argument.
It is.
They're simply saying, if you find there is a scar, that is a permanent, that satisfies the definition of permanent and significant.
That's exactly what I'm arguing. I'm arguing that takes that issue out of the purview of the jury. That is an essential element.
Well, it doesn't take it out of the purview of the jury. The jury is still has to put A and B together.
Yes.
Okay.
Taking out of the purview.
They have to accept the evidence that there is a scar in order to get there.
Correct. And again, it's not contested that there was a scar.
Would you have the same objection to the instruction if it was a model jury instruction?
I'm sorry?
Would you have the same objection to the instruction if it was a model jury instruction?
As it pertains to these facts, I would.
Okay.
As it pertains to these facts, I would, because these facts were so specific. This jury instruction was so specific as to the evidence that the Commonwealth presented. Specifically, there's testimony about a scar that was covered by a beard, a scar that had to be shown to the jury up close, and that's not specifically in the record, but he was taken to the jury box, and they had to stand up and look at the injury itself. It was not visible to the naked eye. So the jury instruction that was granted was so specific as to call out to these facts that when the jury sees the facts presented by the Commonwealth, that there is no discretion for them to say that's not permanent significant injury. And that is my argument, is that their discretion there is tantamount, that they must have the ability to determine for themselves with their common sense that that injury is permanent significant.
All right, thank you, Counsel. You're with both. Mr. Jones.
There was no video in this case, Mr. Jones.
Proprietary or otherwise.
Yeah.
Good morning, and may it please the court, I am John Jones, still represent the Commonwealth, and we're asking the court to affirm Mr. Watford's conviction because the trial court did not abuse its discretion in granting jury instruction 8. So the first thing that I think is important to highlight in this case is that the often repeated admonition against just blindly taking appellate opinion language and turning it into jury instructions is meant to be a warning against the fact that these are often a trap for the unwary. If you're not very careful about how you craft it to the case that you're
in. Most appellate opinions are crafted for the facts of a specific case, and unless we basically say so, it generally doesn't apply, you know, much beyond that. I mean, most of our opinions are unpublished for that very reason.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a good point. But the corollary, I guess, that I would append to that is that just because an instruction, it takes guidance from the opinions of this court as to what the law is and what the law isn't, that doesn't make it somehow inherently suspect or less reliable. This court...
Well, and frankly, for definitional purposes, it's often done.
That's very true, Your Honor, and it's for a good reason. It's because this court states the law, and it's the guidance that we lawyers look to answer questions where you have analogous facts. How does the law relate to specific situations? And so the fact that the jury instruction 8 was derived from an unpub that collected cases with similar injuries to what Mr. Vaughn had in this case, that doesn't make it suspect. It's exactly what it's good practice to do that carefully.
How do you respond to counsel's argument that it impermissibly highlights one aspect of the case?
We've got a lot of law in the books, Your Honor, about how instructions should relate to the specific evidence of the case and how abstract propositions of the law standing alone, I think the phrase is, they do little to help and much to mystify a jury. And Terry and Lilly repeats that point. And so basically without jury instruction 8, the only guidance on significant impairment that the jury would have had was jury instruction 9, and that was physical impairment is defined as any physical condition, anatomic loss, or cosmetic disfigurement, which is caused by bodily injury, birth defect, or illness.
So, and you don't think based on just that instruction, the jury would be capable of figuring out that if they see a photo of the person without the facial hair, and they see a scar, and then they see the person with the facial hair, that the scar might be underneath the facial hair?
I do think that there's a lot of ambiguity that's left if jury instruction 9 had been the only guidance that I think that it increased greatly the potential for confusion, Your Honor, and that's why they needed a more specific definitional instruction that jury instruction 8 provided.
Well, in fairness to your opponent, I mean, looking at the jury instruction 8, it certainly does repeat our jurisprudence, but I'm not sure it doesn't actually, or at least potentially, confuse things, because it says permanent and significant impairment includes visible scars, setting aside invisible scars for the moment, scars connected with nerve damage, and scars not visible during ordinary activity. So arguably, if you have a scar that's not visible at any time, whether it's during ordinary daily activities, that doesn't qualify as a permanent or significant injury. Now, I think we all know what a scar is, and, you know, but what does visible mean? Under a microscope? I mean, you know, just how close do you have to be? Obviously, some scars are really, you know, defacing, scar like right down the middle of your face or something like that. So it's kind of a, you know, when you see it. I think counsel's point is that should have been left to the jury to a larger extent than it was here. So, I mean, how do you want to respond to that?
I guess I would go to this court's precedent in Newton. I think it's instructive of just how specific an instruction can be without improperly highlighting. There you had a chain of custody issue, and the jury instruction that was given basically ran down the testimony that had been given regarding chain of custody, including the signatures on the certificates of authenticity from DFS, and it was objected to as impermissibly highlighting. It was, you know, and this court found that it was not. It was tailored to the facts of the case. It was an accurate statement of the law, and it didn't impermissibly highlight certain evidence. The jury still had to make a decision about whether it believed the testimony that had been given and whether it credited the evidence that was before it. And so that's really where you get into, if the instructions specific to the evidence, as it was here, without suggesting an answer. And I think the court's already pointed out that the jury still had to decide whether it thought that he had scarring and whether it believed his testimony about, to the extent that there was nerve damage potentially there with the burning and numbness and slurring of speech, whether it believed his testimony there. And also,
counsel, can you address harmless error and specifically in the context of the appellant's suggestion that it's not harmless because of the fact that you can't tell if the jury decided solely on the scar under the beard?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that when you have evidence that's overwhelming and undisputed, as we had here, as to multiple avenues that the jury could have found permanent and significant impairment, that it's harmless, Your Honor. And I think that even if the jury's attention was directed to certain injuries, like the non-visible scars and the scarring, to the detriment of its attention being able to be directed more toward, and just for the sake of argument, I'm not conceding that this was the case, but toward the slurring of speech and the burning and numbness, If the jury had more fully considered those more serious, arguably more serious injuries, that wouldn't have redounded to Mr. Watford's benefit. It would have just, the result would have been the same. And where it is evident that there's been substantial justice reached and that even if jury instruction 8 had not been given at all, that we would have gotten to the same conclusion, I believe that's the definition of harmless error. So it is the Commonwealth's position that if the court determines that there was error here, that it was harmless. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yes. Thank
okay.
You.
So, but again, I would just point the court's attention for a much more specific and full, I guess, just more specific instruction that this court has found was still totally appropriate and didn't impermissibly highlight to the Newton case. I think that is very instructive as to how specific an instruction can get without stepping into the province of the jury. And beyond that, unless the court has further questions, I would just rest on my brief and ask that the court affirm.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you very much.
All right, you've got 5 minutes left in rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to briefly again address the harmless error issue. I would submit that you must agree with my supposition that the jury must find aggravation based on the appearance of any scar in order to find that there is no harmless, that this would not be a harmless error.
But there was another visible scar.
I'm sorry?
There was an additional visible scar.
There was two scars, both obscured by facial hair, but they were both there, and they were both shown to the jury, and they were seen.
And the jury saw the photos of the scars.
Correct. My point is, I think you would have to agree with my supposition that jury instruction number 8 says, if scar, than permanent significant. You must agree with my supposition for that in order to find that there would not be harmless error. And I concede that to the court. But I do want to point out a few things, that the Commonwealth is essentially relying on Newton to say that a specific language can be used in an appropriate context. Newton actually uses jury instruction number 9 to define permanent significant injury. They don't need any additional justification for it in that case. So I would submit that if that's okay in Newton, then it would be okay here. And in fact, the case that I mentioned to your honors earlier, the Lamb versus Commonwealth in 2010, where they discussed that permanent injury can be left to the common sense of the jury to determine if injuries are permanent, Lamb cites Martinez, which relies on Newton, which relies on jury instruction number 9, the same jury instruction that the Commonwealth now argues would essentially mystify a jury if left alone. So I think that the idea that this is so ambiguous that it needs clarification is unfounded. And again, on harmless error, I would submit that if the court agrees with my supposition that jury instruction 8 is an if-then scenario, if scar, then aggravation, if scar, then permanent significant, then it's certainly not a harmless error. And in fact, the practical nature...
Let me ask you this, counsel. If you're looking at the... granting for the moment that the language is a little bit convoluted.
Sure.
Is the holding that it is based on simply stand for the proposition that if you have a scar, that counts? I mean, what is not eliminated from that definition? The court could have easily said, it seems to me, you know, if you have a scar, that equals a permanent and significant injury, and let it go at that.
Right.
Do you agree?
They could have. They did not.
Well, I mean, but doesn't exclude, I mean,
doesn't exclude,
it's the functional
absolutely.
Equivalent of the same thing.
Doesn't exclude, includes,
okay,
absolutely.
So if that's the case and a jury instruction had been given along those lines, what would be wrong with that?
It would be very long.
No, it'd be very short. I mean, if you just said, if you had, you know,
if
you find there's one or more scars, that's enough to constitute a permanent and significant injury. If a jury instruction said simply that, what would be wrong with it?
I would be making the same argument that that's not what the courts have held. That the courts have held that those have been determined to be permanent significant injuries, but they've never made that bright line rule that they are all significant, permanent and significant.
But isn't it the same thing, though? There's nothing excluded by that definition.
I think not. I think correct statements of law don't always apply to every case. I mean,
well, they certainly apply if the facts support them.
Sure, sure. But I'm trying to think of a hypothetical that would be similar.
I'll give you one. We define, for example, heat of passion in murder cases. The jury instruction talks about heat of passion, then there's another jury instruction that explains, you know, heat of passion, you know, implies that the mind is not under the control of reason and so forth. That basically restates jurisprudential law from the common law.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, so what, isn't this...
I think
very
this would be more akin to, for a jury instruction in a case in which a husband found a spouse in a sexual encounter with another individual. If the jury instruction were to specifically say the heat of passion includes finding a spouse in bed with another individual.
So you're equating this to that?
Yeah, that's. I think that's more analogous to the circumstance in which we have here.
Thank you.
Let me ask you just a quick technical question. The AG's office argues that the use of force in the commission of a felony is not before the court on this particular issue. Is that correct or not?
Use of a firearm?
Use of a firearm.
It's not on this particular issue. I did ask, the relief requested was that the matter be reversed and remanded for a new trial without the offending jury instruction. That relief.
Relating to both offenses or relating to one offense?
Well, the jury instruction only relates to the aggravated malicious wounding.
Okay. I just wanted to.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, then we will go down to the brief counsel and the court will be adjourned.